This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
A humiliation was how the BBC's political editor described the climb down forced upon Keir Starmer by his own MPs over the government's proposed benefits bill. Any saving the Treasury had hoped to make was reduced to the roundest number of all. The politics is a subject on its own. The underlying problem the government was trying to solve, however, remains. Why has the cost of benefits ballooned so unexpectedly? Who gets them and why? And in principle, what should be done about it, if anything? It all needs some explaining, which is why we're inviting you to step into the briefing room. First, let's find out exactly what the disability benefits are and how you get them. Paul Lewis is the presenter of Radio 4's Moneybox programme. Paul Lewis, what are these disability benefits that we're talking about here?
Well, the main one is personal independence payment, or PIP. It's a benefit that's replaced a number of older benefits in the past. And the purpose of it is to help people who have disabilities cope a bit more with the extra expenses that that disability causes. It's not a benefit that's linked to work. It's not means tested. It's just an extra amount of money that you get because as a disabled person, you inevitably have more expenses.
Right. And then there's universal credit and disability allowance. You can take me through that one.
Universal credit's different. I mean, universal credit is what's called an in-work benefit. It's a means-tested benefit. It's there to either give you a basic income if you don't work or to give you a bit more income if you're on low pay. But if you would find it hard to get work or hard to look for work, you get one of two extras. One is called limited capability for work. And the other is called limited capability for work or work-related activity, which happily is going to be changed to something like health addition in the future.
Now, how much money do people receive on those two things?
So PIP, personal independence payment, comes at two rates, a standard rate, which is £73.90 a week, £3,800-odd a year, and an enhanced rate for people who have more problems with their disability at £110.40 a week or about £5,700-odd a year. And the two rates depend on how the degree of your disability is assessed. Now, in addition to those two weekly rates for your inability to do what they call daily living tasks, there's also mobility component, which is if you have difficulty with your mobility, which can include things like you find it hard to go out by yourself because you're afraid. That also comes at two rates, the enhanced rate again, £77 a week, about £4,000 a year. And the standard rate is just £29.20 a week, about £1,500 a year. And again, it depends to what extent your mobility is compromised by your disability.
And how much is the disability top-up for the universal credit that you mentioned earlier?
The limited capability for work extra is about £36.50 a week. If you have the limited capability for work or work-related activity, in other words, you can't even prepare yourself for work very easily, then you get rather more than that. It's at the moment £97.41 a week. And that's on top of the universal credit that you get. And it's just because you can't be expected to go and look for work to improve your income.
Right. Now, what do you need to do to be able to qualify for the two levels of PIP?
Well, looking at the daily living activities, as they call them, there are 10 categories they look at. Things like preparing food, eating it, washing yourself, using the toilet. But there's also things like verbal communication and can you read and understand signs when you're out and about. And for each of those, you're assessed and you'll get a number of points. Now, if you can do those without any help, then you get 0 points. If you need a little bit of help, you get 2 points. If you need a bit more of what they call assistance, prompting or supervision, then you get 4 points, 6 points, 8 points. And across all those 10, they then add up all your points. And if they come to a total of 8 between them, you get the standard rate of £73.80 a week. And if they come to a total of 12 or more, then you get the enhanced rate of £110. And at the moment, they can all comprise just 2 points. So you have slight difficulty doing a lot of things. That's as good a way to qualify as just having one or two things that you find very difficult or impossible to do without help. For example, if you're dressing, if you need supervision or help to put on appropriate clothes, you get 2 points. If you need supervision or prompting about how to use the toilet, that's 2 points. If you need supervision while you're eating, that's 2 points. So all those 2 points can add up to enough to get the lower or the higher rate.
And can we just re-stress at this point that we're not just talking about physical capacity, we're also talking about some mental capacities to do certain things?
Absolutely. I mean, there are four really that are mental rather than physical. There's verbal communication, there's reading and understanding things. There's engaging with people face to face. If you find that difficult, you need help with that.
Right. Let's move on to how you qualify for the Universal Credit Disability Allowance.
Basically, it looks at your capability to go out and get a job and look for a job. So can you go out by yourself? Can you walk? Can you do an interview? There's pages of it. It's not simple tasks like PIP. And that's done by people in the job centres who are assessing you for universal credit. And they will decide whether you have a normal capacity for work or limited capability for work. And if you have limited capability, can you improve that or not? But the people who do PIP are assessors. They're not employed by the Department for Work and Pensions anymore.
Paul, is this UK-wide, the system you described to me, or does it vary in, say, Scotland?
Universal credit is UK-wide. Personal independence payment has now formally been devolved to Scotland, and it is now known as adult disability payment. At the moment, it is paid on exactly the same terms as personal independent payment is in the rest of the UK.
Paul Lewis, and we'll hear a bit more from him later. The government, like its predecessor, has made it clear that it thinks too much is being spent on these benefits. Tom Waters is Associate Director at the Institute for Fiscal Studies and is here to tell us what's happened to the benefits bill. Tom Waters, first of all, how many people are currently claiming disability benefits across the two categories we've been talking about?
When we look across the number of people who are getting, you know, at least one of these benefits, we're talking now at something in the order of 1 in 10 working age people in England and Wales. So that's about 4 million 16 to 64 year olds. And that's increased a lot since before the pandemic. Back in 2019, that number would have been 2.8 million. So from 2.8 million up to 4 million.
What's the percentage increase of that?
So we're talking about something in the order of a 40% increase, depending exactly what time period you're looking at. You can get 40 or 50% increases over the space of about 5 years.
Has that increase happened at an even rate over that years, or is it accelerating?
At the beginning of the pandemic, nothing particularly happened. And then it was in the middle, kind of end of 2021, when the number of people flowing onto these benefits started to increase quite significantly. And we then were in a situation, still in a situation really, where the number of people who are flowing on each month onto these benefits is about double the number that were flowing on each month before the pandemic. And so we've seen this since then, since the end of 21, this kind of pretty steady rise. And the OBR's expectation is that that rise will continue.
And the projection is for it to go up to about what and by when?
So just before the pandemic started, spending on these benefits was about £36 billion a year. Last year, that number had risen to £52 billion, so £16 billion increase in the space of 5 years. And if there aren't any more reforms, the OBR's expectation is that that will rise by about the same amount again, up to £66 billion by the end of the decade. So across the decade as a whole, we're looking at something in the order of a £30 billion increase in spending.
Okay, so those are the broad figures. How has the profile of claimants changed? I mean, in other words, who is claiming that didn't before and what are they claiming for?
I think what's notable about the increase is it's very much felt across the board. We've seen increases in the number of people getting these benefits across ages. We see it for men and women. We see it in all parts of the country. We see it for different conditions. Pretty much wherever you look, you can find an increase. That said, the increases are faster for younger people, those in their sort of 20s and 30s, and they're faster as well for people with mental and behavioural conditions. So those sorts of conditions have accounted for a majority of the increase since the pandemic.
Now, when we talk about mental and behavioural conditions, what are we actually talking about?
So there's things like ADHD, autism, things as well like depression or anxiety and other problems as well like schizophrenia. So quite a range.
Do some age groups tend to claim more for mental health conditions than others?
Mental health conditions are much more likely to be claimed for by younger people. So if we look at those who are in their 20s or so, we're talking about something in the order of 80% of claims are for mental health problems, 70 or 80%. Once we get up to those who are in their 50s or 60s, it's more like 20% of claims are for mental behavioural problems. I think one thing that's actually quite interesting is the increase in the prevalence of these problems has been felt across all ages, but actually by about the same amount. So all ages have become more likely to claim for these sorts of problems.
Has the claimant profile in other countries altered in the same way?
The really striking thing when you look across other countries, in terms of the total amount we spend on these benefits, at the moment, the UK isn't particularly unusual. It's kind of middle of the pack, maybe a little bit higher than middle in terms of spending on these benefits. When you look at the change in spending, how it's changed since before the pandemic, the UK really stands out. So we've already said there's, you know, something in the order of 40, 50% increase in the number of people getting these benefits. When you look across other developed countries, you don't see anything like that. No one has seen an increase anywhere near that magnitude. And actually, most countries have seen little change or even a decrease. So it's very much a UK phenomenon.
One of the things I always wonder at this moment is whether or not this kind of change was predicted when the benefits that people are claiming were originally introduced. And was this expected or was anything like it expected?
One of the benefits that we're talking about here, personal independence payment, that was introduced in 2013. It was introduced to replace an existing benefit called disability living allowance. And the goal was that it would save money. The government's goal was to cut spending by about 20%. It didn't seem to do that even at the time. It seems like, if anything, it actually increased spending.
So which brings me to a last and difficult question, which is, have the changes been because of significant social changes or because people have responded to the benefit in a way that wasn't anticipated?
If we go back to 2013, as I say, the government's goal had been to shave 20% off spending on these benefits. Seems like, if anything, the opposite happened, it increased spending. It seems like there, what happened was that the way that people interacted with these benefits with PIP just wasn't what the government had expected. And anecdotally, people say it was easier to get PIP than its predecessor if you had a mental health problem. I think in terms of the increase since the pandemic, the jury's still very much out. It's difficult to really point to a cause and be very confident that this is the key driving factor. As I said, we don't see this same thing going on in other countries. And that kind of suggests, well, it can't just be something as simple as, well, this is just happening because of COVID, or this is just happening because of the cost of living crisis, because other countries had COVID, had the cost of living crisis as well, and don't seem to have had any similar effect. Maybe there's somewhere, there's something about the UK that it means it has an outsized effect here. That's one possibility. Another possibility is the process for applying for these benefits has become a bit easier. You can do your applications on the phone rather than in person much more often. Perhaps that encourages more applications. But I think it's still really not very clear why we're seeing the kinds of increases that we've seen.
Tom Waters. And before we carry on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about the conflict between Iran and Israel and what happens now, and the one which asks whether the UK can become an AI superpower.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise-Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, sei in Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise-Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, sei in Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Back now to disability benefits. Paul Lewis has returned to remind us what the government was hoping to achieve. Paul, remind us what the government was trying to do with its changes.
Well, the changes to PIP, it was trying to reduce the numbers of people who got PIP. It was going to make the test to get it tougher. And you'll recall I said that you had to have at least 2 points for various things, that the new rule was going to be you will need at least 4 points in any of those categories. You still need the 8 points or the 12 points to get the two rates, but you'll have to have at least 4 points in at least one category in order to qualify. And that meant that you were, if you like, in at least one area, slightly more disabled, needed slightly more help than the people who had a whole range of two-pointers. And that would have reduced the numbers of people entitled by hundreds of thousands.
Right. And on universal credit?
Universal credit is, there are two parts to it. First of all, the government wanted to change these very different capability for work tests and replace them with the PIP tests. So it would test you in those daily activity tasks, many of which are really nothing to do with whether you're capable for work. It was also consulting on getting rid of the lower amount, that's the limited capability for work amount, where you've had limited capability, but you could be helped and trained to get that capability. And on the higher rate, they were going to cut that from nearly £100 a week, £97 odd a week, to just £50 a week. And then they were going to freeze it. Because that part of the bill has not been removed, at the moment, we think that is going to continue for new claimants, not for existing ones. They have been let off these changes.
Now, one of the original objectives was obviously to save a lot of money. there's some talk that one of the provisions the government also had in the bill cost more money, and that consequently, as we currently stand, the bill saves no money at all.
Yes, or even costs a little bit, I think. One of the things that Sir Stephen Timms, the Minister for Disabled People, said is that because universal credit was inadequate to live on, it was too little, he was going to increase the standard rate, nothing to do with health, the standard rate for everybody.
And what's happened to their proposed PIP changes?
Well, at the last minute on Tuesday evening, when the bill was at risk of being voted down by the backbench Labour MPs, Stephen Timms came to the Commons and said, we are removing Clause 5, the clause which put all these PIP changes into effect. So it's gone. So those PIP changes are not happening.
Paul Lewis. We've had the what, the how much, and the who. Now we need the why and the what next. I'm joined by Louise Murphy, senior economist at the Resolution Foundation, and Ruth Patrick, professor of social and public policy at the University of Glasgow. Louise Murphy, we've heard about how the numbers have gone up significantly and they weren't planned for. Can I get into the question of why this has happened? How do we explain this huge increase?
So when we think about the reasons behind the rising numbers of people in receipt of personal independence payment and or the health element of universal credit, we think there's really three things that we should bear in mind. First is changes to our underlying population. In general, across richer and poorer people, the proportion who report that they are living with a long-term illness or disability has increased dramatically by around 3 million adults over the last decade. So with that change, we would expect that to feed through to some increase in people claiming health and disability-related benefits. And relatedly, our population is also getting older. Particularly our working age population is getting older, as in particular we've been rising the state pension age. So some people in their 60s who a few decades ago wouldn't have qualified for these benefits are now in scope. We think that that demographic ageing accounts for around a fifth of the increase that we've seen over the past decade. There's then two other things we think are important. One, when we're thinking about the timing of the increases that we've seen, we think the combination of the cost of living crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic really is important. Put simply, these shocks put a strain on people's finances and meant that some people who might not have previously been aware of these benefits or seen it as being worth their while to make a claim were more likely to do so. And finally, we should remember that there are some elements of the benefit system itself which we think have acted to change the profile of people who are in receipt of health and disability benefits. In particular, what we have at the moment is a very binary system where the amount you can receive from the benefit system and the expectations put on you around work search and engaging with job centres is very different between people who are classed as unemployed or people who are seen as being too ill to work. That makes a very high stakes system where people that might have a health condition or disability, it really is in their best interest to make a claim.
In other words, that situation has incentivised more people to change the way in which they've claimed and what they've been claiming for.
Exactly. That's not necessarily saying that people are making fraudulent claims or approaching this with bad intentions, just that increasingly the system has become more high stakes. So any rational person who does have a health condition or disability, it really makes sense for them to apply and try and remain in the health and disability related benefit system.
Now, we heard from Todd Waters just what the scale of this increase is. And frankly, it seems difficult to understand it simply in terms of people's changes in cost of living circumstances. Those have happened in other places without the similar increases. But one of the things he did point to significantly was that people were claiming for different things increasingly. Now, that's the what. The question I suppose we're trying to dig into is the why. Why should so many more people be claiming?
I think you're right that the profile of people who receive health and disability benefits has changed, in particular a rising proportion of claimants whose main condition relates to mental health conditions or conditions like autism or ADHD. again, we should remember that that reflects wider trends in society, a vast rising proportion of people who live their lives with mental health conditions. That now stands at around a quarter of working age adults. And so I think if we really want to understand what's happening in the benefit system, we also need to think more widely about other parts of society, public services, the health system, and so on.
Louise, are there any actual really good gold-plated studies of why this has happened, or are we essentially hypothesising?
I think you're right that no one has a crystal clear understanding of what's happened. And I think certainly what we think is important is for any government, this or any government thinking of making policy change, the starting point should be having a very clear understanding of what has been going on and what problems there might be with the benefit system. That should be well known before we jump into making policy change.
Ruth Patrick, cost is one part of this, but the other explanations that people wanting to change the system have given is that, at least rhetorically they've said, they want to get people and help people back into work, not least people with disabilities. Can you tell me how, from your observation, thinking on this has evolved?
I think if we look back across time, you know, we have seen from successive governments a real interest and sort of drive around how do we try and actually use the social security system sort of instrumentally to try to support, but also ultimately in some cases compel people to make transitions from sort of welfare, social security receipt and into employment. And we sort of have seen that really writ large over the New Labour years and then again under the sort of Cameron and Osborne years in these efforts to kind of intensify and expand what we call sort of welfare conditionality. So making conditions on benefit receipt that are attached to participation in the paid labour market. And at different time points over those past 40 years, we've seen kind of concerns with different parts of the population. So in the 1990s, it was very much kind of single parents. And then more recently, there's been growing concern around the employment rates of disabled people and young people. And then when we look at the current reforms, we definitely see that concern and that commitment to trying to say we want to support and enable transitions into paid employment. You know, what the government was telling us is we must support disabled people, more disabled people into the labour market. But there was never, across, you know, the past few months, we've never heard a logical argument about why removing personal independence payments from people would achieve that goal. It makes literally no sense.
Ruth, I imagine that you're not saying that it's not worth trying to help people back into work who have some of the ranges of disabilities we're talking about. In which case, people might say, well, in that case, it's incumbent upon us to come up with a better idea of how that's to happen. So in your view, where would you start?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things I'd say to that. So I think absolutely it's right and proper that we try and support all those who want to take part in the paid labour market, and we support them to do that. And we not only support people to enter work, but we support them to progress in work. That's really, really important as well. But I also think, and I do think this is really, really important, that we have to think more broadly about what we count as a kind of societal contribution. So, you know, lots of disabled people may not currently like feel able or well enough to participate in the paid labour market, but they may be making very big and important societal contributions, be it as carers to disabled children and partners, be it as sort of volunteers in the local community, be it as parents. And I do think we need to move away from a kind of singular like obsession with paid employment. I think if we're going to look at how do we provide more support, we have to get to the root of the problem. We do know that the disabled people face a great number of barriers to employment. So we have to try and look at issues that, you know, that continue in the workplace around sort of discrimination, around both sort of physical barriers, virtual barriers, around you know, the lack of access to kind of jobs that are sufficiently flexible, the lack of support of employers. You know, I've done a great deal of research, like working directly with people that are experiencing poverty, hardship, that are sort of living on social security for all or most of their income. And when you place people in a context of really quite extreme financial insecurity, what you do is you make the work of just getting by harder. And then that means that they don't have time. They can't look to the future. How can I make these steps to progress and work, because they're preoccupied with kind of making ends meet on a day-to-day basis. So I do think we need to think about social security in a different way. So as something that we can invest in, you know, to make longer term changes.
Louise, is there any way of squaring this circle? Squaring the circle, in other words, not having this an endless increase in the amount we have to pay out for in disability benefits, whilst at the same time avoiding the pitfalls that Ruth has just talked about?
I think certainly most people would agree that the benefit system could be improved, both for the experience of claimants and for this or any government that is worried about increasing spend. If we want to make successful policy change, I think we need to start with a clear diagnosis of where the system isn't working, where we think payments are not being used well, and go from there.
But Louise, I'm bound to say, this has been hanging around for years, so why isn't there a clear diagnosis already?
I think that's a good question. I do think part of what we've seen recently in recent months is a mismatch, starting by trying to meet an arbitrary savings goal and working backwards to make a policy change that gets there. Yeah. I think this is an area where coming up with a sensible policy change might not be a quick fix. It might not be something that saves billions and billions of pounds in the next 5 years in the Office for Budget Responsibility forecast period that policymakers are very interested in. And I think that's for the government to decide. If it thinks that there's sensible long-term policy change to be made, then it's incumbent on them to make the case to do that, even if the savings don't show up in 5 years.
And that's all we have time for. My thanks to Louise Murphy and Ruth Patrick. My conclusion? Who'd be Chancellor of the Exchequer? And we'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye.
Hello, it's Lucy Worsley here, and we're back with a brand new series of Lady Swindlers.
Here we are in cell number one. I'm just shutting us in, Ross.
Wow.
Following in the footsteps of some all-new criminals.
Can you take me down to the other end of Baker Street, please?
Certainly, jump in.
Thank you.
Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we revisit the audacious crimes of women trying to make it in a world made for men.
This is a story of working class women trying to get by. This is survival.
Lady Swindlers Season 2 with Lucy Worsley from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Hello. It's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.